Hello and welcome to a special presentation from In the Money Media. PTF back with you from the Brooklyn Salon, Gallery 55, as we call it, upstairs from the bunker here, trying to enjoy some of that nice spring air we've got going here in Brooklyn today. Special presentation because we're doing something that is a departure and something that I could see us doing more of as time goes on, especially if this content connects with the audience, where we talk about betting strategy on a particular bet. And for the debut episode, we're not starting with 101 here. We're starting with about 401, because we're going to deal with, in my view, what has the potential to be a bet that you could get fairly complicated in your approaches to it. Maybe as presently constructed, though, it'll be just fine for the first one in the series. And since we're talking about betting strategy, not that many people on my list that I want to pull in anytime we're talking about these topics, but this one you could probably guess if you didn't already know based on some of the conversations on these type of topics we've had in the past. We bring in the author of Betting with an Edge, professional horse player, Mike Maloney. Mike, how are things?
Everything's good, Pete. Keeneland Open in springtime, Derby less than a month away, and everything, as Marshall Cassidy used to say, it's a day worth living in Central Kentucky.
That's a great line. So we're talking about Hawthorne today, and I know you and I were both big fans of the in concept, you know, talking about lower takeout for a long time. This idea of the place pick all with the 8% takeout, it's one that I'm very excited about in concept. Now, we were talking off air about some specifics that we think might be able to be improved in this bet going forward. We're not going to get into all that here. I will be reaching out privately to our friends over there at Hawthorne and sharing some of the ideas we spoke about off air that might improve this bet and get it running. But it's still a bet that I want to support. Now, I know that the handles haven't been huge. I was looking at the weekend. I think you have the actual numbers there. But, I mean, you know, you're talking about a pool that is going to affect how you need to approach how you're playing, because you would run yourself in danger of overbetting the pot. But still, I think this is such an interesting bet in concept that I want to spend some real time thinking about best strategies for playing it, best strategies for playing it now, and maybe even talk about some best strategies for playing it as time goes on, and hopefully the handle can grow here with some tweaks and changes. Is that a decent overview of how you feel too about this place pick all? Very, very excited about it in concept, but just have to be wary because of the current liquidity issues?
Yeah, I think that's right, Pete. And the place pick all or place pick eight, that bet idea or bet type is always been interesting to me. I remember Southern California, I think, offered that, or certain tracks in Southern California at least offered that in the past. And, it's an interesting bet, and I'm always for, innovative bets at low takeout that can be offered to the players and hopefully, gain a little momentum over time. And hopefully this Hawthorne bet does the same. It's, it's starting out slow, which is understandable. I think the pools were around $1,400 before the 8% takeout, the last couple cards that I looked at. So that's something to keep in mind, is just it's a time maybe to learn about the bet, dabble a few dollars in it and watch it as it goes forward, and hopefully it progresses.
That's a great way of putting it. I do remember the old Southern California version. William Murray, the great racing author, was a huge fan of it. And it was, as I was getting into the game, we've lost Bill. I realized it's going to be 20 years next year. So we're going way back here. And at the times when he was playing it, I had limited bankroll. And what I was going to do in terms of any sort of super exotic bet, we were pooling money often. Frank Scatone, William Murray, and I would pool money and tackle the pick six. So I never really got into the place pick all with him. So this is really the first time I've been thinking about it with the notes that I've scrawled. Let's start with your history. Let's start with your history of the bet. Oh, we should point out, we'll close the show today by taking a look at some of the work you've done on Hawthorne so far in this meet, looking at some so one of the things you specialize in, short-term trends, fluctuations in form of jockeys and trainers. We'll get there, but let's start by talking about your history with the Place Pickle.
I haven't, you know, I don't have a deep history in it, but I've always been kind of attracted to unusual, what I would call more maybe a thinking player's bet, where you just, you know, there's lots of different ways to approach it and a lot of different strategies that come into play. I'm a big fan of the Grand Slam bet that yes. Naira offers. I think that's a real thinking player's bet. You know, there's a lot of ways to approach that. And I, most any card that I handicap seriously at Naira, I'll find a way to play a few Grand Slam tickets. And this, you know, the Place Pick 8 is a, I like, you know, I love that Grand Slam, but the Place Pick 8 offers some of those same intricacies that you know, if you're really a player that likes to deep dive on wagers, it is the type of wager you're drawn to sometimes.
Note to self, later in the year, we'll have to do a Grand Slam show with you. That would be a lot of fun. That is a bet that I have criminally underused over the years that many friends have gotten into. One thing that struck me about the Grand Slam that ties into the Place Pick 8 conversation, I think, or at least it will, this idea, my thought is this idea, as the pools get bigger, will become maybe more important. But I want to just start here and ask you if I'm right with this way of thinking. So the Grand Slam, you know, where you have to have in the first three legs a horse to run in the money. Obviously, Place Pick 8, every horse has to run first or second. Is it not a bet that immediately it makes me think these are betting vehicles where I want to find horses to bet against as much, if not more so, than horses that I want to bet on? Is there any truth to that in either of those configurations?
Yeah, Pete, I think that's true in both instances. But, you know, there are a lot of other factors that play into how you approach the wager too, but that's one of them. It's kind of a knockout horse concept where if you're playing a Place Pick 8 and there's a 3-5 shot in there that you think can run out, if you catch the right horse in that leg and you're right about the favorite, the 3-5 shot running out, you've created a lot of equity just in the one race there that can carry through the whole bet. Same way in the Grand Slam, you know, if you can run out an odds on horse or find a solid reason to dislike or distrust an odds on horse, then you have an edge in the bet.
The issue here with the pools being what they are and the minimum being what it is, all four $1 minimums when it comes to most horizontal wagers, I do think, and this, again, this is something we'll reach out to our Hawthorne crew about, if there was ever a bet that should have a low minimum, though, you could make an argument, it might be this one, simply because in betting against a favorite, a big favorite in a bet like the Place Pick 8, I'm going to probably want a little bit of coverage, maybe take two or three horses to try to beat that horse instead of just picking it exactly right. That gets very hard to add horses in the Place Pick 8 as it's pleasantly constructed. I know you had done some quick back of the envelope math about multiple horses in legs in this bet, just to give some context.
Right. The first thing I do when I'm looking at an unusual bet or a new bet for me, or a bet I haven't made in several years, or just to get the math right in my head and to give me some guardrails, like I'm always talking about, which just are just kind of common sense math or basic logic ideas that keep me from going off on crazy tangents with my betting. Yep. If you look at a Place Pick 8, if you were to use three horses per race, which is way too many, I understand that, but just for the illustration purposes of showing how the math works out, you do that at the minimum of $1 and you've bet over $6,500. if you use
more than what the pool is, you know,
five times what the pool is. Yeah. So you don't want to do that. If you use two horses per race at the minimum, you would bet $256, which is still, you know, you're over betting the pool. You can't do that.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mike. I totally get why over betting the pot is a bad thing, but let's explain for some of the newer audience.
Oh, okay. Well, if you know, the couple of cards that I looked at, the total pool for the place pick eight at Hawthorne was around $1,400. So if, you know, at 8%, the takeout's around $100, say you've got 13, this is just rough math. Say you got $1,300 to pay out. My general rule that I use when I'm looking at pools is no matter how much I like the situation, even if it's a carryover, which, you know, this is not, I try to never bet more than 5% of the pool in any situation. So, you know, 5% of the pool in this situation is about $70. Right. So it would just, if I stay within my guidelines and my guardrails, my rules that I've established through a lot of pain from making bad wagers earlier in my career, if I stay true to those principles that have been good to me and the betting principles that I know are right for me, at least, I'm not supposed to bet over $70 in this pool under any circumstances, and probably less. So,
and the danger of betting more is essentially that it messes up the risk and reward. Is that where that?
Yeah, I should have framed it that way. Yeah, it's just that, you know, the basic premise of all wagering is risk and reward, and your reward in this case, if you sweep the pool, is, you know, roughly $1,300. You don't want to send $256 after $1,300. If you were to sweep the pool, which is an unlikely circumstance, it's just the odds are not in your favor. So, you know, that just the basic math that we use when we're trying to determine what's a good bet, what's not so good a bet, and how much to risk in a certain bet. You know, you just start with basic math, and the math here is that you have to, you know, dabble, as I said earlier, in the pool. At this point, and then hopefully the bet begins to handle more, and it gets to a situation to where it makes sense to play a ticket where you can, you know, play a couple $100 and use two horses a race if you need to. I would probably never structure my bet with exactly two horses in every race, but there might be a time where there's a couple of odds on horses that I think are beatable, and I might want to use three horses in a 12 horse field, maybe just to try to catch a long shot that might run second with the odds on horse running out. So I want coverage in that race. And when you stretch that out over eight races, it's not hard at a dollar minimum to end up with a ticket that's a couple $100, even if you're trying to be careful. So, you just, as the bet, hopefully, as the pool grows, it will open up more wagering strategies to be able to be used, you know, in good conscience by smart bettor.
But let's talk about where we are now. Personally, I understand it might not be, the best wagering theory ever to still want to wade into a pool of this size with, say, $50 to $70. But personally, where I am in my gambling, not doing it for a living, doing it for fun, wanting to support bets like this, I'd be absolutely comfortable taking a swing at that level. With that in mind, what is your first instinct about how you'd look to play, to structure a ticket and a bet like this, place pick eight? I'll go first. My first thought is play it almost like, at this point, play it almost like lottery ticket and just pick a horse in every race and bet it for more than the minimum and just see if you can give yourself some action and have some fun, since it's going to be very hard to do anything too technical with such a limited, let's call it $70 budget in a dollar bet, one thing you could do where I know you wouldn't be getting the worst of it and might have some fun is to just play it lottery ticket style. But what comes to your mind as a potential?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that will come to my mind is when I said 5% of a total pool, that would be in an optimum situation for me. That's my upper limit. So that's if there were a carryover and I had an edge at the track and, all the factors were in my favor. That would be like if I, you know, the analogy would be I'm counting cards and I get the perfect setup and I'm going to push as many chips as I can in front of me. That's when I would bet 5% of a pool. In a situation like this, probably what I would do, Pete, is I would say, you know, there's a chance that just by running even a 2-to-1 favorite out of this bet, in a leg or two legs at the most, you might sweep the pool. So, I would be kind of on the other end of it, and I would be looking to bet $10 or, you know, maybe 20 and single almost every race, use a couple in the races that I felt were more open or where there might be a vulnerable odds on horse, and, you know, just have fun, as you're saying, with it that way. The one thing I would want to avoid at this stage of the bet would be to overbet the pool, and I would tend toward underbetting it. You know, at this point, I would just throw the least that I could throw at it, you know, and with giving myself some chance to cover. And odds are you're not going to hit it for $10. Or $20, but it is a kind of a fun bet to keep up with. If you get through three or four legs, you know, some especially for players that are in it more for fun than they are for profit, or at this stage of the bet, you can have a lot of fun with that. You can bet a $12 ticket and stay live for a few races and maybe get all the way through and have bragging rights with your crowd that you took down the new bet.
Is it similar to other horizontal wagers where the strength of your singles is going to be just a huge part of your success in a bet like this? I mean, is that a place to start from a handicapping point of view? Is what are the, gosh, I mean, you need what, four, probably more. You probably can only spread in 2-to-3 legs here, typically, I'm thinking. Is that exactly. Is that your starting point?
I think that's exactly what I'm thinking. My ticket would probably have 5 or 6 singles on it, and then, you know, 2 or 3 at the most spreads, probably just a couple, and those spreads would be really tight themselves. You know, you're not gonna be able to do a lot of spreading. I think at least the way I would approach it is I would think of it strictly as a place bet. I wouldn't try to overcomplicate it. I would, you know, if you see a horse that, you know, I love to find horses in this situation that are almost have a little sucker horse tendencies. You know, a horse maybe that started 20 times with one win and 5 seconds, something like that, or, you know, a horse those type of horses a lot of times are some of the more consistent horses at the track. A lot of times your horses that in the, when we're talking about, you know, a lot of these races you'd be looking at would be claiming races and some of them condition claiming races. And in those type of races, you're pick five, you're looking for the fastest horse for sure. In this bet, the fastest horse is certainly a consideration, but you're also looking for the most consistent horse and the horse that's the most reliable to show up. So if I find that horse that it looks like what we call a trial maiden sometimes at the track that just tends to run second more often than any other position, that's he's perfectly singleable in a bet like this.
Yeah, that's a great point. And some people might carry that bias about the, you know, the 1 for 17 might work against a lot of people wanting to rely on that horse. So maybe,
you know, what occurs to me, Pete, that you're, if you're, once you get really involved in a place eight, your place eight ticket shouldn't look exactly like your pick five ticket. They should look a little different.
What are some other differences? You know, the sucker horse can become the key horse. That's one big difference. I'm guessing something, another thought flicked across your brain there when, as you made that observation though.
Well, you have the horse that I kind of, I forget what we call him in Betting with an Edge, but he's kind of the unreliable jump up horse that is even money, and he's either going to win by eight, or you could picture him like running off the board at the same time. So you may need to include that horse in, if you don't have the perfect horse to oppose him with in the place pick eight, you may have to include that hit or miss kind of, I think that's what we called it in the book, was hit or miss type. And maybe use the most reliable other horse that you can find. So in a pick five, I might be willing to single the hit or miss horse because I know that his best race wins. And maybe there's four horses that are his main contenders that I can't separate. So if I don't single the hit or miss horse in the pick five, I'm looking at a much more expensive ticket, and I just choose to live or die with the hit or miss horse. In a place eight, I would be less likely to do that.
I think that makes perfect sense. Obviously, consistency is something that we prize in racehorses as betting vehicles all of the time, nowhere more so than the place pick eight, I would imagine. It just feels like if you can get a race where you don't have to deal with a hit or miss type and you know you've got a horse whose typical race gets you there, that those would be the ideal building blocks, I would think, even though they'd be pretty obvious. With eight legs, you have a lot of places to get clever. I wouldn't want to get clever betting against a horse that showed any kind of consistency, and I probably wouldn't want to spend a lot of extra money backing up that horse. I'd probably be willing to live or die in this bet with somebody who is on the more consistent end of things, even if they're not super fast.
Absolutely. I mean, we all see races where a horse is, you know, 8-5 or 2-1, and we don't necessarily want to bet him to win, but we're totally willing to key him in our exactas. He's going to be first or second. Those horses are, you know, they're not enticing to me in pick threes or pick fives, but they'd be a stone single in the place pick eight.
That's a great point and a good way to use those horses. If this bet had, this is a funny question to ask, but if this bet had more liquidity and if there was a lower minimum, that's where for me, my gut would be to really turn it into attack the weak favorite with three horses in some spot. The kind of thing that I just don't think the risk and reward is justified with where we are right now with the bet. Does that sound like the right idea to you though, in a world where the bet takes off and you could afford more combinations, or
if there's 20, if there's 20,000 in the pool, then I have an entirely different approach. When I look at the bet, I'm going to know that I have options. You know, I don't have to bet what an Uber ride costs or less. You know, I have the opportunity to maybe, you know, in certain situations, I might play a few hundred dollars into that bet. If I, you know, maybe I see a couple of odds on horses that I don't trust or maybe there's a bias in play where, for instance, speed's good. And I see a couple of, 20-1 morning line speed horses that I think are going to clear. And if they clear on that kind of track, good chance that even if they lose, they hang on for second, hopefully. So it would just open up a lot of options, you know, for a player. And just honestly, just make it more interesting because It's a lot more interesting to shoot for 20,000 than it is for less.
Sure. We applaud the idea. We're going to be following the bet. I think that's a good place to leave the place pick eight discussion for now. We'll get more into those theoretical strategies as hopefully as this pool continues to grow. But something you said there when you were talking about bias struck me, obviously, with this bet starting in the first race right now. It would have to be like a days long bias for you to be able to prep for it. That made me want to ask you, you know, I know you've pulled some info about connections. We'll get to that. But have you seen anything bias-wise in the days at Hawthorne you've looked at? I know you play at least semi-regularly. Have you noticed anything about how this track is playing at the moment?
Well, you know, I haven't. We've got a lot of tracks that I'm interested in going on right now. So I'm not going to mislead by saying that I'm watching Hawthorne as my, you know, as my number one track right now. I'm not, but there are times of the year where I'll play Hawthorne, you know, pretty seriously. I like the track. Right now I would be spot playing there. And from what I've noticed, spot playing, and by spot playing, I mean, I would be, you know, looking at, horses that I've maybe put on a watch list or that I've flagged that ran at, fairgrounds, for instance. A lot of those horses will ship into Chicago, ship into Hawthorne. And so I've got a bad trip or a horse that ran against the bias at fairgrounds. And, when he's entered at Hawthorne, I'll take a look at those races and see if there's a bet that makes sense for me. And in doing that and watching some races there, I don't think there's been a huge bias, but I think tendency I've noticed is it probably helps to be close, and it probably helps to save a little ground like it does at most dirt tracks. And, sure. Hawthorne starts the meet, which makes total sense. There's a lot of horses that take the winter off in Chicago, and they're coming back off a layoff for the beginning of the Hawthorne spring meet. And therefore they're not, all of them aren't ready to run extended distances. So they card a lot of 5-furlong races the first few days, and then 5.5 furlongs. And then I think, you know, they'll, I glanced at Saturday already, and I think they have some 6-furlong yep. sprints. So, they'll just gradually work those distances up. So you have to factor that in at 5 furlongs on the dirt. You know, most tracks, it's probably going to look like inside speed's pretty good.
Yes. It almost has to, not to do with any bias so much as just the nature of what you're dealing with here. What about connections to start off the meet? I mean, a lot of times when you have these horses coming off of layoffs, horses coming from different places, you can really pick up on some tendencies that can pay in terms of the barns they're coming out of. What have you noticed thus far?
Well, a lot of it, I'm going by just how well the trainer's horses have performed or not performed so far for the meet. Just a few names that I'll throw out here for people that are interested in Hawthorne. John Arnett has 17 starters, 4 wins, 4 seconds, and 2/3. So he's obviously an informed trainer, off to a good start. I want to give those trainers a little extra credit. I'm a firm believer in whether it's trainers or jockeys or baseball players or quarterbacks or whatever it is in the world of sports, that momentum is a real thing. And it's not always just a mental thing. There are things that, you know, a player may be over an injury that bothered him, and therefore his performance improves. A trainer may be just his horses are healthy, his barn is healthy, there's everything is going right, the races are being written that suit his horses, so he's able to find the right spots, he draws the right posts. You know, those things just seem to work together sometimes, and I want to participate in, I want to bet my money on trainers and riders that are doing well. I mean, they don't have to be the leading trainer at that point or the leading rider, but I would prefer to bet my money on on participants that are doing well versus participants that aren't doing well. So another guy that's off to a good start, Armando Hernandez, has started 8 horses with 3 wins and 3 seconds. So he's off to a great start. And the third one I had listed for the hot trainers was Tracy Tanner. I noticed that his record is he started 11 horses with 3 wins. He doesn't have any seconds, and he's picked up a third, but 3 wins out of 11 starters. And I don't associate him as being a really high profile trainer. So there may be, there may be value with some of those horses. I noticed that Tracy Tanner shipped to Hawthorne early, and the horses show works in February. That is something that works at a lot of tracks too. If you notice a trainer that is working horses before most of the other trainers at your target track, that's just a sign of intent to me. You know, he got there early. It's just common sense that maybe his horses are more acclimated to the track. And obviously he's in some way targeting that meet by getting his horses there early and working them early. So those are all positives to me. I'll wait till I do the other end of the cold trainers until I go into that. The cold trainers that I've noticed so far, Earl Hughes, he started 9 horses. He's got Donuts 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Vance Childers has started 10 horses with only a second to show for those 10 starts. Fernando Bahena has started 6 horses with no horses in the money yet. And I don't know a lot about any of those trainers. I do know that Childers is a trainer that I've seen on the opposite list at Hawthorne before, where he's been a trainer that I've specifically tried to bet his horses. So that's just an example of how this is. I'm not saying first 3 guys are great trainers and the other 3 guys aren't. It's a lot of it is just flow and momentum and guys come into form and out of form. And one other thing I'll point out that I think may be helpful that you don't see in a lot of books and you don't hear a lot of conversation about. The trainers that are hot, and this, I guess, comes under the heading of just ending up back towards the mean in the end. The horses that are starting out hot, I will keep an eye on those guys. I'm looking to bet them right now. But the guys that are starting out hot, there's a tendency, most of those trainers, by the end of the meet, they will possibly underperform to some degree because they will tend to revert to the mean.
Out of conditions too. There's reasons beyond just the flow of randomness why that happens. I think that's a great point. When you note these trainers, this is something I'll put in my trip notes: barn cold, barn hot. You know, you want some context for it. And of course, if you're willing, you know, to do the extra work, and Formulator makes this easy, you go through and you look, especially with a small sample. You know, normally I'm not in a hurry to make a decision on a guy who's 0-4. But if you're 0-4, know it not hitting the board with 4 horses that are under 6-1, I might put you on that cold list, you know, at that point too. Just as a couple ideas to piggyback on, I know, Mike, you've been very generous with your time today. We only have a couple more minutes, but I want to just throw that idea out there as one for people who are interested in building off this work and doing more of it themselves.
Yeah. And one other thing I want to touch on, Pete, is also the trainers that are the cold trainers, you know, right now, those are, you know, that's a money-making opportunity. If you just have those guys in your head, and this is one reason why, especially if you're more of a beginning horse player or you're trying to advance your game, it's you'll learn so much more and you'll probably have better success. I know I have. When you focus on 1 or 2 meets and deep dive into those meets, for instance, with these Hawthorne trainers that were on the cold list, if I'm seriously playing that track, I'm watching those guys like a hawk. I'm not betting their horses. But if I see, and their horses are mainly going off at big prices now because it's obvious to everyone that they're not on the top of their form. But the first one of those trainers' horses that I see that's 20 to 1 that maybe takes a tough trip or fights a bias and only gets beat a couple of lengths, I'm going to have a big smile on my face, and I'm going to be writing some notes, and I'm going to be trying to flag every horse that trainer has in the rest of the card and in the following day's card. Because
wake
that,
them up.
Yeah, yeah, could be a wake-up situation, and that's once again back to the card counting idea is, you know, that's when the face cards are still in the deck when that situation presents itself. You actually have an edge, and you can, if you're ahead of the game and you're waiting, you're betting on the guy with the first horse he wins with instead of the third one, then you actually have an edge in that situation.
The problem with waiting for the sample size to develop is then everybody knows it. You make money based on making bets on the come, like Mike is describing, I would say, to use another gambling analogy. You've got to be a little bit ahead if you want to maximize the value, even though you don't want to be drawing any long-term conclusions off of small samples. From a risk and reward point of view, that could be a good place to speculate. One last very quick question, and then an observation, and we'll get out of here. The question is, when a trainer is on the cold list like this, does that mean you will not bet them on any tickets at this point, or does it just mean that your odds requirement would be higher? Say if a horse looks like a 6-1, maybe you wouldn't bet him unless he's 10-1, or are you just off until they show signs of waking up?
It would be very, very rare that I would key a horse in off the cold trainer's list. If I absolutely love the horse, and he's trained by a trainer on my cold trainers list, I might include him as a contender, but I would rarely, rarely ever key him, because if I key him, I'm risking my entire bet on the fortunes of that horse. And it, you know, that's another one of my guardrails where, you know, I think it's good for a gambler to have things like that in place, just rules basically that keep you from doing something on an emotional basis, you know, before that's really against your rules if you sat down and thought about it.
I think that makes all the sense in the world. All right, we're done. I do want to say, when you talk about specializing, not just saying this because they're clients, I believe this fully, sort of a mid-major like Hawthorne would be the kind of place I think you could really try to specialize and get an edge, as opposed to a track that has, you know, all the eyeballs on it. And it does feel like a track, since courses are coming in from different places. Look, it's so hard to be computer players playing any track, but it does seem to me like a place like Hawthorne where you could build up potentially institutional knowledge. And if you were selective and specializing in it, you might be able to find a type of edge that's much harder to find at a major circuit. Do you think that's a fair observation?
I wouldn't disagree with that. And, I review the tracks that I'm looking to play every year, and then the tracks that I put on a lower tier that, you know, that I'm looking to play less. And Hawthorne consistently is one of the tracks that certain times of the year and certain days of the week and certain situations that I play on a serious basis.
Mike, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you.
You're welcome, Pete. Anytime.
Thanks one more time to Mike. Thanks to our friends over at Hawthorne. Thanks to all of you for listening. Lots more content coming down the pike on the In the Money Media Network. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.